Good evening, everybody. It's April 25th, a little bit late. So really, I want to welcome everybody. And I know it's a lot harder in June than in April, but I want to thank the Shire family for sponsoring it. They have Yahrzeit on the 6th of Iyar, I believe, and in memory of their mother, which was the time this event was originally planned, and just extended it. But I guess on a personal level, today is the first Yahrzeit of my father. So in this sense, it's intertwined, and it's, I guess, an honor to have the families, you know, enjoying together. We should come together on happy occasion. But as I mentioned last week and other times, I really feel the best way to memorialize a parent, anybody, is through the learning of Torah. Torah is the eternal bond of the Jewish people. It links the living and the dead. We talk about people who have passed as if they're alive. So I really think that's a beautiful way to honor your mother. And I want to thank you and introduce you to say a few words. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Jay. And welcome, everyone, and welcome to our guest speaker. And really, it's an honor to be able to, for us, to be able to honor my mother's memory and to just say that what meant so much to her was a connection to education, to learning Talmud Torah. She was born in Toronto, grew up down in Kensington, and moved from Major to Brunswick to back and forth, different streets, Augusta. And but became very involved in schools here in Toronto. She was on the Board of Jewish Education and instilled in all of us a love of the importance of education and Ahavat Yisrael. So thank you very much, really, for the opportunity to be associated with Torah in Motion, which is such a marvelous institution here in Toronto.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamet. The subject of this evening is refusing military orders in the Israeli Defense Forces. It's known as Siruv Pikuda. It's a complex phenomenon that takes different forms depending on where in the ideological spectrum the particular form of refusal emerges from. We're not going to be talking tonight about the separate but related issue of those who refuse to serve in the IDF at all, but rather those soldiers who are in uniform but object to specific types of orders. And predictably, the refusals are related in one way or another to some kind of action having to do with the territories or Hebron. Some refuse to serve anywhere outside of the 1967 borders, considering such activities to be immoral and illegal, and a perpetuation of what they see as the occupation of Palestinian land. At the other end of the spectrum are those who believe that soldiers should refuse any orders that would involve evacuating Israeli settlements and expelling their residents. They term such orders as illegal and thus feel it is imperative for soldiers not to heed them. We'll be focusing on those refusals this evening. And Siruv Pikuda reflects the ever more complicated feelings of some in the religious Zionist world about the relationship between the land and the state. As in the comments of this soldier, quote, I know how to differentiate between the state, which is a great kindness from God, and the leadership of the state, which is a great embarrassment to the Jewish people. There's a red line which I'm not willing to cross to help evict Jews from their homes, unquote. And such comments are representative of a certain segment of the populace. The threat of such acts has reemerged in the past few years, leading to a confrontation in December 2009 when Defense Minister Ehud Barak actually called in the head of the Har Bracha Yeshiva, Rav Eliezer Melamed, to ask for clarification of his views. Rav Melamed refused the invitation and has publicly written that if a religious soldier is given an order to evacuate settlements, he must not obey such orders as a principle of faith. Then, following that, the Har Bracha Yeshiva was told by the government they're no longer part of the Hasdir Yeshiva system. So this evening we want to discuss whether there is in fact a growing pattern of disaffection among religious Zionist youth regarding carrying out orders that they may see as in direct contravention of the Torah and its ideals. What is the role of certain rabbis and public figures? Are they advising soldiers that particular orders should not be followed? What will the overall effect of this be on IDF morals? What does Jewish law say about such refusals? Are there conditions under which refusals are permitted, or are they always halachically impermissible? What can we expect in the future? And so on. There's no one better suited to address these questions than Rav David Stav, our guest this evening. Rav Stav, who's no stranger to us, has been with Torah Motion before, is a graduate of Yeshivat Merkaz HaRav, is the rabbi of the town of Shoham, as a co-founder and a leader of Tzohar Foundation, and is the spokesman for the Rosh Yeshivot Hesder. He is also the co-founder of the Hesder Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. Won't you please welcome Rav David Stav. Rav Stav, before I ask you about the halachic issues involved, I would like you to explain what you see as the relationship between all of this that we've been talking about and the hitnatkut, the disengagement. Would you say that these refusals are partly in relation or a consequence of the evacuation of Gush Katif?
Well, first of all, good evening to everybody. First, I have to begin with apologize for missing the flight on the date, on the previous scheduled date that I was supposed to come here to speak about this subject. And I'm really, really sorry for missing that that flight. Now, answering to your question, I would like to add one more topic to what we all, what we are going to discuss this evening. I guess most of you are aware of the fact that the last news in Israel, besides the news from the Mondial, refer to the riots, to the demonstrations that the Haredim do against the decision of the Supreme Court that has been taken just a few days ago, referring to the school, to the discrimination, to the what they called as almost a racial discrimination between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim in the town of Emmanuel. And as a result of this, hundreds, maybe tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox people demonstrated yesterday and the day before in Yafo and other places. Well, on its surface, it seems to be that there is no connection between these two subjects. But when we come to dig into the roots of this conflict, of this dispute between the religious society and the non-religious society in Israel, we will understand that there is one fundamental root for these conflicts, and it has to do with the disengagement, with the hitnatkut. The basic question that the Jewish society has to confront with since the establishing of the Jewish state 62 years ago is, what is above what? The law of the halakha and or the law of the state. Well, usually we were not used to put this as a contradiction, because in most cases the state has nothing to do with religion, with religious laws, and there is no such a problem, never existed, except of very exceptional cases like people that didn't know whether to, if they worked in hospitals and they had to treat patients in ways that maybe were not suitable to the laws of the halakha. But usually, a normal man never faced a contradiction between law and Jewish law, between the law of the state and the law of the halakha. The first time that this issue became a national problem was around the time of the hitnatkut, of the disengagement from the Gaza Strip. Not because there were not previous occasions, but this put it on such a national level It was discussed in the media. It was discussed in the papers. It was a matter that the rabbis have discussed it between themselves for the first time. We had a previous experience in 1982 when there was a big withdrawal from Sinai as a result of the peace agreement with the Egyptians. But it's nothing to compare, because then all the rabbis, even Reb Avrom Shapira, that was the previous chief rabbi, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi that was given the order of refusal, he was the head of the rabbis that commanded the students, the boy, the yeshiva boys, to refuse to orders of evacuation of settlements. But he didn't say this in 1982. In 1982, he wrote a letter in which he recommends the soldiers to obey to the orders. And I will explain later, maybe as a result of questions, what's the difference between the disengagement and the peace treaty with the Egyptians in 1982. But there is no doubt that the disengagement 5 years ago gave a very, very big push to the position to encourage people to refuse to orders.
Why do you think it gave them that push? What was the impetus there?
Well, first of all, the feeling, I'm not justifying that feeling, but the feeling that the government doesn't work in democratic ways. You know that there was a kind of a questioning the people, the voters of the Likud, and Ariel Sharon did not obey to the results of the poll that he has made. And he fired ministers that didn't agree to his decision. He fired them 2 days before the decision of the disengagement was received by the government, etc., etc., of things that did not look to the people as democratic decisions. That's one thing. And second thing, the feeling that there was no real reason for this disengagement, the feeling that there was not a real reason for this disengagement besides of one of two reasons. Either to get rid of the criminal a suing of the Prime Minister, or one that was one feeling. The other reason that people felt that there is a decision that was made against religious people because they were religious. And despite the fact that I'm not a part of that feeling, of both feelings, but still this way of receiving decisions, and the feeling that there was no real benefit from this step of, from this decision of the disengagement, gave the people the push to understand, imen ani limi, if I don't take responsibility for what I'm doing, no one will do that. And if I feel that I should refuse, so then I will do that.
So do you feel that the Siruv Pukudah is really a sign of a deeper division then between, say, younger religious Zionists and the state? I know that there were even some from Gush Katif who will no longer celebrate Yom Ha'atzma'ut. Do you see this as a small trend or something that you think may grow?
I think we have to differentiate between two levels of connections to the Jewish state. A few months after the disengagement, the government started a war, the Second Lebanon War, and there wasn't even one case of a religious soldiers that didn't want to serve in the army. Last year, 2 years ago actually, in the operation of in Gaza, all of the religious soldiers that went to the army, there wasn't even one case of a soldier that said, I don't want to go to the army because this army was cooperating with their disengagement. That's one level. I think that the religious society is very mature and understands that there is no other possibility but to serve in the IDF, and there isn't another alternative in this game. On the other hand, the feeling towards the government became more and more kind of, people feel that they are disengaged, they have disengagement with the government, and people feel, and what we see just in the last few days, it's the same process. This week it happens with the Haredi society. A few months ago it happened to the religious Zionist society. But the same process, the same trend is surrounding the entire religious society. The feeling that the government doesn't count them, doesn't refer to them, and because they feel that this is the government's attitude, they react as to what's expected from them in such circumstances.
Let's switch over to the halakha. Maybe you can clarify for us, what does Jewish law say about refusing orders from a duly elected Israeli government? Is it, and on the other side, is it permitted to evacuate Jews who reside in the land of Israel?
Now, so far I felt like I'm in a neutral position, and I describe it like a representative of the UN that comes to Israel and tries to analyze what he sees in front of him.
Okay.
But I'm not a part of the UN, and I have a position, and I express my position very clearly in Israel. I don't feel, I'm not a partner to that feeling, to what I was describing for the last 10 minutes. I feel, well, first, before I describe what I feel, what I believe, the halacha says the following, and that's the problem that we face after 2,000 years of being in exile. Whenever there is a contradiction between moral values and the laws of the state, halachic values and laws of the state, I think that there wouldn't be one religious person that would dare to say that the law of the state is above the law of the halacha. I think that everybody understands that. It has nothing to do even with halacha. It has to do with Jewish, and not even with Jewish, with moral values. There used to be in Israel a very, very left-wing professor, Yeshayahu Leibovich, who used to say that whoever says that the law is above everything is very similar to those, I don't even want to say the words, to those in Europe in World War II that said that the law is above moral values. And if the law of the state requires us to kill people, despite the fact that we understand that it's against moral values, if they obey to the state, it's a kind of fascism. So, there isn't a moral man in the world that will say that always the law of state is above moral values or above the law, the values of halacha. Maybe just... I just wanted to finish the point. But, well, so I think that there isn't, if you put the contradiction or the dispute about the issue of what is above what, so I think a religious man will answer, halacha is above the law of state. But it's not that simple. Because the question that we have always to ask ourselves, what is the halacha? What does the halacha has to say about issues that are in halachic disputes? What do we expect from the government? Let's say there is a dispute between two rabbis, not about withdrawal from territories, from Yehuda and Shomron. Let's speak about another issue. Let's, as a spokesman of the Hesder Yeshivot, I know that we face these problems every day, on a daily basis. Let's say there are two Rashi Yeshivot that don't agree between themselves about the question whether you should brush your teeth and shoes before davening in the morning, early in the morning when you get up in the army, in the training basis, whether you should brush your teeth and your shoes before davening or after davening. So there are boys from, we have Baruch Hashem, almost 70 Hesder Yeshivot. So we have 70 Rashi Yeshivot, and as you could imagine, 70 Rashi Yeshivot, you have about 100 positions. So now you have a few boys that serve in the same unit, and they come, and the commander comes to them and says to them, look, 6 o'clock in the morning, davening, 5:45, you have to brush your teeth and your shoes. And then one of the soldiers raises his hands and says, my Rosh Hashiva said it's forbidden. The other one says, my Rosh Hashiva says it's permitted. Now, what do we expect from the commander to do now? What should he do? Now, these questions comes to us, these kind of questions, we face every day. It's about brushing teeth. It's about jogging before davening or after davening. It's about kinds of food. Someone says, I don't rely on Rabbanut, I want only badatz. And the other one says, I want badatz bet Yosef. And the fourth one says, I eat only machput. Machput is the name of a very famous Sephardic rabbi in Israel that has a very specific, very special supervision. So, what do we expect from the army to do in such a situation? Now, we are confused. The government is confused as well. We have plenty of rabbinical positions when it comes to the main issues of, let's say, evacuation of Jewish people from their settlements, disengagement, other issues. Now there are a few positions. What do we want from the government? So Reb Avraham Shapira said the following. He said it 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago. No, 30 years ago. 30 years ago. Almost 30 years ago. He said the following. If a government has a position, a rabbinical position to rely on, she doesn't have to take all rabbinical positions in consideration. She could rely on one position and says she wants to withdraw, and she has Rav Ovadia Yosef that gave her the permission to do that. It's okay. But if she doesn't have, it's considered among all rabbis that this step is forbidden, so then the halakha is above the state. And if not, not. That's one condition. A few other rabbis say it's not enough. Even if it's against halakha, it depends. What kind of decision the government received now? If the disrefusal, if the fact that you will refuse will cause people from the other wings of the political map in Israel to refuse in when the government will take decisions that they wouldn't like to these decisions. So then it's considered to be a pikuach nefesh for the entire state. You cannot allow soldiers to demand from the government to obey their political view just because the halakha requires it. Because if each one of the soldiers will have this privilege to demand his commanders to obey to his political view, so then the army will never be able to exist, will never be able to act. Could we imagine a unit of troops with just a few weeks ago, we had to come, the group of the soldiers of the Navy that captured the ships that came, that wanted to go through the, to go to Gaza to bring supplies. Could we imagine that one of the soldiers would have said to his commanders, look, I refuse to do that because it's against my political view. I refuse to go without guns because I think you are not right. You don't take the right decision because you better go with long guns, not with the revolvers, because we have to protect ourselves. Either way, an army has to work as one unit. You cannot expect the army to succeed despite the fact that we know that we paid high prices. We pay the political price just recently with these ships. We pay every time prices for mistakes that the government is taking. That is the privilege of a government to decide, to make mistakes, and to pay the price for these mistakes. And usually we pay. The citizens pay the price. But we prayed 2,000 years to come to that situation that we'll be able to make mistakes, unfortunately, and in our times, hopefully, to have to succeed by getting other decisions that will bring us to a better place.
So what you've just said seems very clear to me on a national level. I'm wondering what you think on an individual level. In other words, what would you advise a soldier to do if he's given an order that he feels he simply cannot accept according to his conscience? Should he, and I'll give you two options here. Should he follow the order anyway? Or should he say that he can't do that and accept the consequences of that decision, even if it means going to jail, let's say?
I think that this is the problem that we faced just recently. I will tell him, if you feel that it's against your values, against your moral, please don't follow the orders, go to jail. But don't tell and don't try to encourage others to do that, and don't put flags in the hotel, in the wailing wall during the marching of the soldiers or whatever they are doing. You don't demonstrate in the army. If you feel that one of the orders is against your moral values, don't do that. We are not, as a part of the democratic world, the democratic liberal world, we respect the right of people to refuse orders that are against their values. What we don't respect is a kind of a rebellion against the government. This is considered to be, according to the halacha, as mored b'malchut. You know, David HaMelech, he asked Uriah Hiti, one of his colonels, to go to visit his wife. He wanted to cover what he was doing to his wife. But anyway, our sages defined Uriah Hiti as a rebellion, because he said to the king, how could I go to my home when my soldiers are in the front? He showed solidarity with his soldiers. But still, our previous sages refer to this as a rebel. When the king tells you to do something, you don't tell him, how could I do that? How could I go to my wife while my soldiers are suffering in the front? The same thing applies to what we are doing, to what we are dealing with now. If you don't want to do something because it's against to what you believe the halacha says, or if you don't want to do something because it's against your moral values, it's okay. I respect it. But be ready to pay the price. And the price is to go to jail.
And what do you see as the role of the Rosh Yeshiva, or the person's spiritual leader there? There's a bit of confusion, I think, that all of us have when we read about this as to how much authority do the heads of the yeshivot really have over their students in this matter of refusing orders. Will students listen if rabbis tell them not to refuse orders? In other words, is this something that is really stemming from or coming from their teachers, or is this something that's really coming from themselves?
I think the boys choose the Rosh Yeshivot according to their positions and not vice versa. I mean, the students that came to our bracha came to our bracha because they knew that these are the positions of Rav Melamed. And the boys that are coming to Gush Etzion or to Petah Tikva go to choose this yeshivot because they know that they know in advance what the positions of their Rosh Yeshivot are. It's not, it's a bit, you know, people think in paradigms of previous generations. Our children don't need the Rosh Yeshivot to teach them what to do in these circumstances. They take the decisions by themselves. They do it already when they are 14 years old, 15 years old. I guess all the parents here know that their children take decisions when they are very young. They get mature very early, maybe too early, but they don't need the Rosh Yeshivot to teach them what to do.
Have you spoken with Rav Melamed at the time? And can you tell us what he said to you about his position?
Well, first of all, I spoke to him many times.
Right.
Since I had to represent him in front of the Minister of Defense when I met him, and the other, the Chief of Staff, and other people that we had to deal with in order to help him or in order to represent him. Well, I think that he knows that his position is not accepted by most of the Rosh Yeshivot. I think he wanted to bring it to an edge. This contradiction between the law of state of the law and the law of Halacha helped him to raise an issue on a national level. He believes that despite the fact that he paid the price, his yeshiva doesn't, is kind of a government budget, and it's a lot of money, but still he believes that now the government understands, I'm not sure that he's right, but that's what he believes, that in order to evacuate settlements from Judea and Samaria, it would be very, very difficult as a result of his struggle.
So you're saying, in a sense, that he picked the fight here because of what, anticipating what might happen in the West Bank.
Correct.
And hypothetically, what do you feel would happen if the government in the future ordered the evacuation of one of the larger settlement blocks in the West Bank? Because it wasn't really so long ago, if I recall, that Prime Minister Olmert was toying with such an idea. Do you feel there would be a widespread Sirif Pekuda at that point to carry out such orders?
Yeah. Not as a result of a religious position, but as a result of a social position. The feelings that are taking place among the youngsters, especially in the religious society, Zionist religious society, are so bad against the government that it will lead to a refusal of the orders. Not because halachically people will believe that this is the right position, but people will take advantage of this event to express what they feel about any other things. Uh-huh. So that they will take advantage in such circumstances to try to prevent this evacuation. But to be honest with you, I don't see the next disengagement taking place so soon. Hopefully it will never happen, but it doesn't seem that to me, and I think to others, that the government has the power to do such a thing. Recently, all governments in Israel are very weak as far as taking hard decisions with the people. And to be a government, to be a prime minister that dares to do such a thing, you have to be a real Sharon. And I don't see any other leader in the horizon, in the Israeli horizon, political horizon, that will dare to do such a thing.
I don't know if you can gauge this, but what do you think the sort of non-religious public thinks of soldiers refusing orders?
It's not a question of what I think. It's the question of what the polls show about this. And that's very interesting. You know, after the two soldiers that put the flag that say that we will never be ready to evacuate Jews from the places, there were polls done in the Israeli society, and I was very astonished to see that about 35% of the non-religious people supported them. Which means that I don't think that they supported the position, but it means that they believe, the non-religious society felt that, okay, they've done something wrong, but we don't have to exaggerate about the meaning of demonstrating in the army, and you don't have to punish them that much. And I think that people, it's the same thing happened this week, the same thing with the parents in Emmanuel that didn't send the children to the school. It's against the law. Parents have to send the children to elementary school or to high school. But you'll never see a government that will arrest parents that don't send the children to school. Okay, it's against the law, so you should fine them $1,000, $2,000, but you don't take people for such reasons to prison. And the people felt that there was a kind of exaggeration about the behavior, the treatment, that the attitude that the government held to these people, to these soldiers that were held in prison for more than 30 days or 40 days.
I'm going to open up questions to the floor, so I'm just going to ask you one more, and before I take the mic around, and it's sort of a larger question. Given these kinds of tensions that we're seeing in the last few years between the government and the religious Zionist community, do you personally still view the state as Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, as the beginning of the redemption?
Sure. Baruch Hashem, we have to face these kind of problems. Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem that after 2,000 years that we never dealt with questions of state, we have to deal now with these kind of questions of contradictions between the law of the state and the law of the Torah. Baruch Hashem. Ashreinu. Ashreinu, we are so privileged to confront these kind of questions. Baruch Hashem, we have more than 70 Hesder Yeshivot in Eretz Israel. We have hundreds of Zionist rabbis. We have hundreds, thousands of Zionist religious officers in the army. It's for the first time in the Jewish history that the Jewish people begins again to create an environment of kingdom, of Jewish kingdom. V'atem tiyu li mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. When you live here in Toronto, in such a beautiful city, but you live as individuals. You live as a small community. You don't have to run a state. You don't have to run a police, a Jewish police, Jewish army. I could declare with no doubt about it, that since David HaMelech, there was never more Jewish army than we have in this time. I could share with you questions that officers, religious officers, ask us. It's unbelievable. Could you imagine that last year, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the first of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, in most of the bases, the training of the soldiers, of the tanks, of the paratroops, took place at the night before Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, because most of the officers had to fast. So the training was from midnight until almost sunrise, and then they all went to daven shachrit, and then went to sleep. That's a Jewish army. We never experienced such an army, such a thing before. When my son that serves as an officer in the paratroops, and he sends me a question in the cellular, during the operation in Gaza, he sends me the following question. we have to hold an ambush in a strawberry field. Can we use, in order to keep us awake during the night, are we allowed to eat the strawberries, the Arab, the Palestinian strawberries, during that ambush, during the night? And he's waiting to an answer. Is it permitted or it's not permitted? Is it permitted to use water when you come to one of their houses? Questions that show, that express our moral values, our religious values. It's a beautiful state. That's Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. This is what is all, that's what we all dreamt about. If someone thought that when we will establish the Jewish state, everything will go smoothly and there will be no problem, so then he doesn't know what Jewish people are about. Could you imagine Jewish people gather together and they have no problems?
Thank you.
I spent a year at Bar Ilan too, and I'm familiar with what the Hesdot Yeshiva used to be. It's nice to hear that there's 70 of them now. The figure I was given in Toronto was 200. The figure that I, when I first went to Israel in the late 50s, it was much less, and there were more religious soldiers. Are the Hester Yeshiva still for soldiers?
I didn't understand the question.
Are the Hester Yeshiva still for soldiers? For all this, the Bar Ilan and the Hester Yeshivas and this Yeshiva, when I knew them, was all an outcome of Bnei Akiva. And I was in Bnei Akiva since I was 8 years old. I'd like to know why Mizrahi is no longer, or a Pole on Mizrahi is no longer represented politically, and that includes the Bar Ilan and the Hesder Yeshivas.
Well, you pointed a very interesting question. There is a very big gap between the political representative of the religious Zionist movement and the growing of the religious Zionist society. There is a very big gap between these two. And I'm not an analyst. I can't analyze the process why we came to reach to that point that we don't have more than 3 representatives in the Mafdal or 4 representatives in the Ichud HaLeumi and the National Unity. But I think I don't belong to a party. I'm not representing a party. I'm representing a movement. The movement is the religious Zionist movement in Israel, which is consisted of hundreds of thousands of people that their kippah sruga is their sign, is their flag. The combining between academy, secular studies, and Jewish studies, army and yeshiva is their flag. The representative are in the Likud, in the Labor, in Kadima, even in Meretz. I don't give them marks. I'm not a politician, so I don't give them marks. But I could say that the religious Zionist society is spreading out to so many areas, and one of the prizes could be the political representative.
Do we have a floating mic? Right, I'll take it off. Is that one further?
Or can we have them line up, maybe?
Let's see.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, the expression Dina de Malchuta Dina, as applied outside of Israel, obviously would probably mean that when there's conflict between halakha and the law of the state, the law of the state, I would imagine, has to predominate. But in terms of where you say that the halakha supersedes the law of the state in terms of running the army, how is it that, where does the dina, the malchut, the dina come into play at all? And also, if you could just spend a few moments on analyzing the halachic analysis of the question, where the answer comes and what is it based on, I'd be very interested to hear.
So, dina de malchut adina refers to civil laws. For instance, if the halacha considered someone that borrowed a pen, suppose you borrowed me a pen, so the halacha says that I'm responsible for everything that will happen to this pen that I borrowed from you. Suppose that the laws of the Canadian government are that if I borrow something from you, I'm not responsible. So then, the halacha says, look, since I borrowed the pen from you, under the Canadian authority, we can assume that we both agreed that the Canadian law will apply to this borrow. Suppose the Canadian law demands or requires various demands when you want to sell a house, to buy a house, whatever. So then the halacha says that dina de malchut adina. But suppose the Canadian law will say you must work on Shabbos. You must write on Shabbos. Chas v'chalila. No one will ever dare to say that the Canadian law will supersede the halachic law. That's for sure. Now, so that's for the first question. By the way, democratic liberal governments, anyway, will never try to force someone to do something against his belief, against his faith, because it's against the roots of liberal democracy. The idea of democracy is not only that the majority decides. That's a very primitive democracy. Developed democracy understands that it's not that everything is depending on the majority, because the majority doesn't have the right to force someone to do things against his beliefs, his fundamental beliefs. And that's why it will be accepted in Canada, in the States, and elsewhere, that the government has no right to force someone to work on Shabbos, to be mechalel Shabbos. But anyway, even if they would have decided to do that, it's understood that it's against the halacha, and you don't have to follow these laws that are against the halacha. Now to come to your second question, it's very complicated, but we'll try to summarize it in a few words. There are two questions that are in dispute in this issue of disengagement or evacuation of people, evacuation of settlements for peace treatment. There is one question, if the government is doing an isur, is acting against the halakha because of one of two reasons. Number one, the Torah says, Lo techunem, which means you should not give them your land. That's one thing that the Torah says. There is another issue that's written that the Ramban says that it's a mitzvah to conquer Eretz Israel, the land of Eretz Israel, and not to leave other sovereignties to be sovereign on the land of Israel. So these are the two issues that are in dispute. The question of the Ramban, the second issue that I've just mentioned, is the question if this position of the Ramban is accepted by everybody. There are many others that said that his position is not accepted. The first point of Lo Techunem, everybody agrees that this law applies to the current situation. But there are others who say that in under the circumstances of saving people's lives, what we call pikuach nefesh, it is allowed to withdraw from these territories, to give these non-Jewish people chanaya, to let them live in this piece of land, and they bring as a proof the fact that Shlomo HaMelech gave 20 cities to Hiram, that was the king of Tzor. He gave him as a present 20 cities, and there was no criticism on him. So there are people that say that this is a proof that it is allowed in certain circumstances. Why did I say that there is a difference between the question of 1982 and the last disengagement? Because in 1982, Rabbi Avraham Shapira said, we thought that we gained something, that we gained a peace treatment with the Arabs. But in the disengagement, everybody knew that we don't get nothing. It's just in order to do something that no one could explain what benefit we'll have from this act. So that's why Rabbi Avraham Shapira said, here, there is no excuse for the government to say that she relies on a certain halachic position. That's what short summarized for the question that you have just asked.
So I'm glad you came back to the difference between, say, Yamit and Gaza. And the two reasons basically you've given before was that it was the difference was Sharon was doing it for his own political saving his neck, and also that he had made commitments about a referendum, and then he said, oh, I got the wrong answer, I won't do it, so there's a lack of democracy. But there's also another element I would suggest, which was during that time, there was a lot of, if you will, demonization almost of the settlers, somehow that they were viewed as a cause of problems, a cause of soldiers, even in Gaza, you know, soldiers are risking their lives for what? For the settlers. So there's a sense of division that was created by the government. And one hears that in many cases, say, let's say leftist soldiers, who are, people try to make allowance for them not to serve in the territories, in the Shtachim. And yet, that doesn't seem to be the case, or may not be the case, with the religious Zionists, that there seems to be this attempt within, or the fear that the government will try to stigmatize. And there have been statements in the media, right, to basically stigmatize officers, there are too many of them. You know, there are worries about them getting into the general staff. And the sense that should the army itself participate, is this really a role for an army to participate in this kind of division? Because there's a risk there also that to use the army in this manner can jeopardize the whole state. So there seems to be, I would suggest, and like to hear your comment, a point to push the government to say this is not a role for the army itself. And it's only by soldiers sticking their own individual necks out that people can begin to take that position and say, okay, this is a police activity. This is not, the army is too important for the state. How can we let it be used and abused in this way?
Well, first, I think that you mentioned a few things. I want to refer to all of them. Well, I must tell you that there was a kind of stigmatization of the settlers in 1982 as well. It was much worse then. Then the stigmatization was about the settlers, that they want a lot of money for their houses. Now we forgot it, but at that time they were all blamed for squeezing, for demanding huge amounts of money from the government. That's one thing. Now, the question that you raised about the role of the army, is that the role of the army to take place in such evacuations? The truth is that you are right. And the chief of staff already said that he doesn't want the army to be involved in this. I mean, you don't have to be right-wing in order to understand that the army is torn up to pieces by doing this kind of dirty job of evacuating people from their places. But to be honest with you, despite the fact that it's not the role of the army, I'm not sure that as someone that is in favor of the settlers, that I prefer to see the police there. The police is very, very well known to be very violent, to use a lot of violence. I don't know the translation of this unit in the police. We call them in Hebrew Yasamnikim, Yechidot Siyu Miyuchadot, very, very tough guys that, you know what, when we demonstrated against them a few times, we said that we expect democratic states that will not have this kind of units, but Israel needs them, especially in order to fight against the Arabs, but from time to time they use them also against Jews. And these people, I'm not sure that I want to see them evacuating my friends, my brothers. So despite the fact that it's the role of the police, and you're 100% right, I'm not sure that I want to see the police there. But if, God forbid, there will be such a case of another disengagement, most probably the police will do that. But I'm not sure that the results will be much better. I mean, the police is maybe it's their official role to do that, but I'm not sure about the results. And we all remember the experience of Amona when we saw the policemen on the horses, and we say in Hebrew, "En laem Elokim," they have no God when they have to evacuate people from places. So I'm not sure that it's a preferable solution.
Thank you very much for your insight. I guess I want to go back to a point you made right at the beginning, which you said was very important in understanding the situation, in that it involves like social groups that are trying to maintain their solidarity and some of these issues. You pointed to the one where I believe there's the parents are leaving a particular school system because they're not maintaining separation between the Sephardim girls and the Ashkenazi girls. And I'm wondering, is there a rabbinical role in these situations to say, hey, in some situations we have to do things to maintain our religion, our morality, and in some situations maybe there should be like a compromise to encourage the people or to hopefully bring the Sephardim up to the level of the Ashkenaz in the school system?
Well, to be honest with you, since it's not this group is not my cup of tea, I'm not sure that I'm the one to represent their positions. But what they claim to say is that the separation between the girls is not on an ethnic basis, but on a religious basis. Which means they say that the girls, the Ashkenazi girls, learn with Sephardic girls as well. But they insist on a certain level of religious behavior, religious observance. Well, I'm not sure if it's true or not. I could tell you that I will answer to your question and try to generalize your question. In Israel, there are always two kinds of groups. Like in the same, that's the connection between these two issues. I told Rav Melamed once we discussed this issue. You could bring this contradiction between law of state and law of Torah to the edge. You can bring it to that, and you could slap, you could take the law to his to an absurd, to one edge, and you can emphasize. And you can say that you insist on kutso shel yud, you insist on each letter of law, that you want it to be exactly, precisely according to the halacha. You know what? I'll tell you a story. It sounds silly, but it's a real story. When we wanted to show Rav Melamed what kind of absurd he brought us, I'll tell you the following story. There was a group of soldiers that was in the middle of training and shooting. And they said they wanted to daven mincha. Okay. There were about 20, 25 boys. Okay. So they made a break and they said, okay, now we daven mincha. No. We want to daven, we want you to bring us with a truck to the basis, because we want to daven in shul. Now, I couldn't deny that there is an issue to daven in shul and not in the field. But to be honest, I guess that if we have 10, 20 people somewhere in the valley, and if I will raise my hand and I will say, who wants to daven, to join me, to daven minche, I guess all of you will come and will join me, and no one will say, no, I prefer to wait until I come back to Toronto to daven in shul. I guess this will be the normal answer. Now, you could say that there is an inyan to daven in shul, and no one will be able to deny it. But if you understand that you are now in the army, and that you are in the middle of the training, and you don't have to drive your commanders crazy to bring you to shul, so then you daven in the place where you are and continue with your training, correct? So you can compromise, you can do efforts in order to compromise, and you can bring the conflicts to a crash between themselves. And there are rabbis among us, among the Haredi as well, that are interested in creating that accident, that crash. And there are rabbis, I think that I represent most of the rabbis, that try to do all efforts in order to give the people the feeling that the law of halacha and the law of state could work out together smoothly if we just try to do an effort to let it happen, to let this kind of solutions to exist.
Rav Stav, I want to thank you for, I appreciate very much your coming and clarifying some very difficult issues. Thank you very much.